From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, Democrats have set up a war room to plot out their steps in an effort to eliminate the legislative filibuster in the Senate if Joe Biden wins the presidency. Why? Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker is here to explain. Earlier today, I was at the White House for the signing of the Abraham Peace Accord, a historic peace agreement between Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain. The U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, joins me later here on Washington Watch. Also, parents in California are outraged over the state's new radical sex ed policy that includes lessons on children choosing their gender, finding and using birth control, and locating abortion providers. Jonathan Keller, president of the California Family Council, is here with the details. And authors of a study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, which claimed individuals suffering from gender incongruence found relief through gender-affirming surgeries, have had to correct their study. What was the correction? Dr. Andre Van Mol, co-chair of the American College of Pediatricians Committee on Adolescent Sexuality, is here to explain. We'll also talk to FRC Senior Fellow for Policy Studies Peter Sprigg later here on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter or Parler, it's at T Perkins. And let me remind you, coming up next week, 1 week from today, the annual Values Voter Summit. Now, normally I would be calling you to Washington, D.C., and hundreds of you, thousands of you would come to Washington, D.C. for the annual Values Voter Summit. In fact, this is the 15th anniversary. It's hard to believe we've been doing it that long. But this year, you can join with us no matter where you are because it's virtual. And we're going to be hearing from some of the same people. We're going to hear from the president. We're going to hear from members of the Senate. We're going to hear from members of the House. We'll hear from other leaders in the conservative and the Christian communities. All you need to do is register. Go to TonyPerkins.com. It's free, no charge, but register and be a part of the 2020 Values Voter Summit. America, it's time to pray, vote, and stand. Go to TonyPerkins.com and you can register for this year's Values Voter Summit beginning next Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, every night next week, Tuesday through Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern time to 9:30 Eastern. All right, according to the Associated Press, Democratic insiders have set up a war room to quickly kill the Senate legislative filibuster early next year if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris seize the White House. Now, the way the legislative filibuster works is that while it only requires a simple majority, normally 51, to pass a piece of legislation, the rules that have been in place for years in the Senate require a 60-vote threshold to approve moving to debate or ending debate. So while it only takes 50 to 51 to pass a law, it takes 60 to get to the law. Now, some would say, well, that's crazy. Well, that's long been the rule. And yes, it does slow things down. But it has been the means by which a number of bad ideas have died in the Senate. So why the push to do away with the filibuster? After all, that's what the members of the Democratic Party have done to kill police reform, have killed the coronavirus relief measures. So why then do the Democrats want to do away with the filibuster if Joe Biden becomes president? What is it that they're up to that's so unpopular? Joining me now to talk about this is Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi. He serves on the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, Tony, thank you very much, and you've outlined it pretty well. Let me say at the outset, it's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you, sir. It's good to have someone from a neighboring state of my home state of Louisiana here, Mississippi, one of the great states in the South. I hope you all are not going to get too much water from the hurricane coming through.
Thank you, and we would appreciate being remembered.
Yes,
it's going to be a tough day or two.
Yeah, we're accustomed to that down on the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about another hurricane, and that's what happens if the preparations being made now, if Joe Biden were to capture the White House. There are plans in place now. The Democratic insiders putting together this war room to plot out a strategy to eliminate this legislative filibuster. Why?
Well, you know, you said the filibuster slows things down. That's exactly what it was designed. That's what the Senate was designed for. As a matter of fact, it's been said that the creation of the United States Senate, which is unique around the world, was an original stroke of genius. It not only slows things down, as George Washington told Thomas Jefferson it was intended to do, but it also promotes consensus. It promotes bipartisanship. And still, some of the major accomplishments that the federal government has been able to do have been done with the consensus that was brought about by the filibuster. The Social Security Act, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, they all had to overcome a filibuster, and the result was bipartisan compromise, legislation that has stood the test of time and reflects broad consensus. And that's what we need in the United States Senate.
But, Senator, is this a reflection of where Washington, and I would have to say the rest of the nation, as we see what's happening on the streets of America, that there is a polarization, an ideological polarization that has taken place where it's become more and more difficult to work together?
Well, that's true, but it's also a reflection of where the Democratic Party wants to go. I mean, mm-hmm. The American people are going to be heard, and I certainly hope Donald Trump is reelected and Republican majorities result in the House and Senate. But if they do get everything, here's what they want to do. They want D.C. statehood, and they know they can only do that with a bare majority. That's an extra two senators for the Democrats for the foreseeable future.
Let me stop you there for just a moment, because I want to make sure our listeners understand what we're talking about here. D.C. has long been trying to get statehood. It was never designed to have statehood. It's always been in fact, I don't think there's ever been a Republican governor here, mayor here. It's always been liberal. And they want to make it a state. It would be the 51st state that would give them two senators, which shifts the balance in the Senate even more. And then from there, that enables them to do some other things that they would like to do that will basically secure their control over the federal government for years to come.
Right. The other thing they'd like to force statehood on Puerto Rico, although the voters down there on that island have never had majority support for statehood. They like their own situation down there. But, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution to say there are 9 members of the Supreme Court. That's a matter of statute. And if the filibuster is abolished, our Democratic colleagues intend to increase the number of Supreme Court justices, and this is reminiscent of what FDR tried to do.
Exactly.
When he had a little trouble with his New Deal, he just proposed court packing, and people from the right and left rose up and said, no, that's not fair. But this is absolutely something that could be done with 51 votes and the signature of a President Biden or a President Harris. The Supreme Court could go from 9 to 15 with the stroke of a pen.
And let me, again, explain what that means. We are one Supreme Court justice away, and I know you have a stellar record on the life issue. In fact, you've led out. You're not just voting right on the life issue. You've led out on the life issue as a leader. We're one vote away on the United States Supreme Court to seeing America becoming a predominantly pro-life nation again and Roe v. Wade being sent to the dustbin of history. That would be changed under this scenario that you just laid out, because they would pack the court with liberals, and all that has been accomplished in terms of moving the court back to its constitutional boundaries would be lost. Is that correct?
That's correct. And not only that, because we have to have consensus in the Senate, we've been able to preserve the Hyde Amendment for all these years. The late Henry Hyde had an amendment that prevents taxpayer funding of abortions. the Dickey Wicker Amendment is still the law years after J. Dickey passed away and I moved over to the Senate. It prohibits the destruction of embryos using taxpayer dollars. All of that would go away if we don't have the bipartisan consensus requiring mechanism of the filibuster. If you like right-to-work laws in your state, and most of us have them, that's one little bill. Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act could be abolished with 51 votes and a Biden signature, and there's no right-to-work left anywhere in the United States. It's a stunning and bleak future that this war room is planning for our country.
Now, I know there have been some conservatives outside the Senate that in the early days of the Trump administration were advocating for eliminating the filibuster, the legislative filibuster. I've never been a supporter of that.
Thank you.
I think, as you've described it, I've heard it described this way, kind of an illustration that the House is the teacup, and the Senate is the saucer. And the hot tea goes into the cup, and then some of it spills out into the saucer, and it cools in the saucer. And that's really what the Senate is. It slows things down. But quite frankly, Senator, I have to say that not all that much that comes out of Washington is good. And so I think the less Washington does, I think the less it does, the better. Now, an example of where there was bipartisan cooperation and shows that it can work when people want to was the first couple of iterations of the coronavirus relief efforts, where there was a unifying effort there to work together. Now, that's since fallen apart. But, you know, when the American people speak and say we want something done, we tend to see Congress respond.
Absolutely. We're in the political season now. Thank you for pointing out that these very same people who have designs on abolishing the filibuster were happy to use it against mm-hmm. Tim Scott's police reform bill for the sole and only reason that he is an African-American Republican who's articulate and conservative and connects with the general public in a fantastic way, only because that was Tim Scott's idea and Tim Scott's bill. Did they use the filibuster to prevent us from even getting to the bill for amendment, for debate, for discussion?
Senator, I'll use a biblical reference here, and it's not. I'm not. I know the scripture doesn't speak to the legislative filibuster, but it warns not to remove the ancient landmarks. And I think the meaning there is that when you're going back and undoing something that's been in place a long time, you need to think hard and long about doing that. And I think when it comes to the legislative filibuster or changing the Constitution, you got to think long and hard about that because there are repercussions for those decisions.
Well said. Well said. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi. I'm telling you, they're trying to line everything up. Folks, you need to be paying attention. What's at stake in this election? All right, coming up next, earlier today, I was at the White House for the signing of a historic peace agreement in the Middle East. We're going to be talking about with the ambassador to Israel next. Don't go away. Are you concerned with the state of our nation? And when looking at what's going on in our culture, do you wonder, what can I do? For the past 15 years, FRC Action has hosted Values Voter Summit, an event for people like you who want to shape the culture so that all human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. And this Values Voter Summit is going viral, so everyone can tune in and be encouraged to pray, to vote, and to stand in these significant times. Past speakers included President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Dr. Ben Carson, and Dana Loesch. Register today for your free digital pass and join us virtually from September the 22nd to the 25th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information. That's valuesvotersummit.org. Don't miss out. Remember, pray, vote, stand.
Since the 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision, Congress and many states have taken various actions to stop taxpayer dollars from funding abortions or the abortion industry. As early as 1976, Congressman Henry Hyde led the effort to ban federal funding for abortions. The Federal Hyde Amendment, named after him, established the principle that abortion is not health care, and therefore taxpayers should not be forced to fund abortions. Despite these efforts, the abortion industry still receives millions of dollars each year in taxpayer money. In 2019, Planned Parenthood, America's largest abortion provider, received $616.8 million in government funds. Family Research Council's newly updated pro-life map tracks how your state has taken action to stop taxpayer funding of abortions. Go to frc.org/pro-life maps to see where your state stands in the fight for life. That's frc.org/pro-life maps. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Hannah.
What's going on? Why so gloomy?
Well, I'm a little disappointed. I had a lot planned to do during the stay-at-home time, and I just didn't do it.
Oh, yeah? What did you have planned that you didn't get to do?
Well, I was actually hoping I would finally be able to get time to do a regular Bible reading routine, and I started a couple of times. I just didn't stick with it.
Don't be too down on yourself. Starting a new routine can be hard, but one way to help is to join in with others and to have a good game plan. I think I have a good solution for you.
Oh, yeah?
Tony Perkins and FRC are doing a 2-year study in the Word. They have it all mapped out.
When did they start? I would be so far behind.
Oh, that's not a problem. You can literally jump in anytime. There's a daily reading, just a couple of chapters a day, with questions to help you think about what you're reading.
Nice. Where can I find this?
Go to frc.org/Bible, and you can get started.
Where's that again?
frc.org/Bible.
Got it. Checking it out now.
Welcome back. This is Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So good to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. And by the way, take the challenge if you have not yet taken the challenge to pray, vote, and stand as we head into one of the most important elections in the history of our nation. As I mentioned earlier today, I was at the White House for the signing of the Abraham Peace Accord. This is two historic peace agreements. One between Israel and the UAE, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain. Joining me now to talk about this, the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman. Ambassador, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony. Great to be with you.
Ambassador, let me just start with this. Explain to our listeners what took place today, the significance of these peace accords. What do they accomplish?
Well, what they accomplish in the first instance is creating the first peace agreement between Israel and an Arab nation in 26 years. The last one was 1994 with Jordan. Before that, it was 1978 with Egypt. And those are the only two peace agreements that Israel has had in its 72-year existence. Now, within a period of a month, we've doubled the number of peace agreements now to four, one with the United Arab Emirates and one with Bahrain. And, you know, what this does is it makes Israel safer, more secure, more prosperous. It opens up to Israel enormous opportunities for trade, for culture, for tourism, at a time when Israel's economy is, as all economies are around the world, under tremendous pressure. It gives Israel another trading partner, two trading partners of real consequence, at a time when Israel is trying to wean itself off of investment capital from China, which we believe is not in Israel's best interest or in the best interest of the United States. Israel now has an outstanding, safer, better source of capital to some extent from its new friends. But above all, you know, we've taken people for 50, 100 years have been enemies of each other, haven't spoken to each other. You couldn't make a phone call, you know, from Israel to the Emirates until last week. The lines were blocked. And now all of a sudden you have people very, very quickly working together for the collective best interest. It's a wonderful model, a wonderful template for the region, and we believe it'll be followed by many other countries, all to the benefit of the region and I think especially to the benefit of Israel.
You mentioned the two previous agreements with Jordan and Egypt, and I've obviously been to both places quite frequently and a lot, and I see the sharing, the economic activity, the sharing of intelligence for security purposes. So, you know, clearly there's an economic benefit here to Israel, to Bahrain, and to the UAE. There's also security, working together against a common enemy of Iran, as well as radical Islam in the region. Of course, the pandemic putting everybody together. But I want to go. I was there today. And by the way, let me just say this, Ambassador Friedman. I think you're one of the best ambassadors that the United States has had to Israel. And I applaud you for the role that you've played in, number one, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, the recognition of the Golan Heights. I know that was the president's decision, but you were a key part of that. So I want to thank you. You've been a great representative of the United States to Israel. I'm grateful for your leadership. Now, I want to ask you this question because today the foreign minister from the UAE mentioned that this halts the annexation of the Palestinian areas by Israel, which was a part of the peace and prosperity plan that was rolled out earlier this year. So does this agreement in any form or fashion limit Israel's sovereignty over Judea and Samaria?
No, I don't believe it does. And let me, if you'll give me a couple of seconds, I want to, these are, you know, it's a very important question. I like your, to make sure that your listeners understand this well. Number one, and just a couple of different points. Until the Trump administration came around, the foreign policy of the United States, Republican and Democratic administrations alike, was that Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria were illegal. They were violative of international law. We reversed that policy. We reversed that legal analysis. Secretary Pompeo has concluded in a policy and legal statement that the Jewish settlements in Judea and Samaria do not violate international law. So that's something that we've done that no one had ever done before. When we put out our peace to prosperity plan, we also had a very critical component in it, which is that no Jewish community within Judea and Samaria would ever be evacuated. Again, there's no other administration that's taken that position or anything close to it. Let me
provide some context, because that's what we're talking about happened in Gaza back in 2004, 2005, where that was given over to the Palestinians, and the Israelis that were living there were moved out, correct?
Correct, and it was a disaster.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted people to know what we were talking about there.
Yeah,
that under this plan, that'll never happen again.
That'll never happen again. We learned a painful lesson from the evacuation of Gaza. Gaza was only 8,000 Israelis in a relatively remote part of the country, and it almost caused a civil war within Israel, and it has resulted in terror attacks that have been almost unending, including today, including this very afternoon. 13 Israelis were wounded from rocket attacks from Islamic Jihad coming out of Gaza. So Israel's not making that mistake again. We would never ask Israel to make that mistake again. The Jewish communities within Judea and Samaria, if Trump is president, we will never suggest that they leave, and our plan provides that they will never leave. The flags that fly there today, the Israeli flags that fly there today, will fly there forever. Another point which I think is important is there's been some suggestion that the ability of Israel to build within its communities in Judea and Samaria is somehow limited, that somehow there's a settlement freeze. Absolutely not. The Trump plan has laid out the Jewish communities within Israel, and our expectation is that they will continue to be developed. The last point that you made, which is where there has been a change, is the timing of the declaration of sovereignty, the timing under which Israel would make the political determination to apply its laws over the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria. That's been slowed down. It's been slowed down in order to pursue what we consider, and what I think all the Israelis consider, to be an enormous opportunity to make peace with these two countries and another, you know, 5 to 10 more. But there is no obligation on the part of Israel to stop or not to declare sovereignty. They'll work with the United States on timing.
Ambassador, we're going to have to leave it there, but I'm going to get you back on when you're back in the States to talk more about this. Ambassador Friedman, thanks so much for joining us. Folks, stick with us.
Oh, man.
What's wrong?
I just missed Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, and our congressman was going to be on the show today.
Oh, that's not a big deal.
What do you mean?
Well, you can always catch the replay of the day's show.
How's that?
With the Stand Firm app.
Yeah?
Yep, you can catch that day's program and so much more. You can contact your elected officials on campaigns and policies that are important to you with the Take Action tab. You can listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins live and play previous episodes while conveniently going about your day. You can access the Washington Update, informative blogs, tweets, and critical campaigns on the main feed, so you can stay up to date on local and national news.
Wow, I definitely use that. How do you find the app?
Just visit frc.org/app and download, or search Stand Firm in the App Store.
Okay, that's Stand Firm.
Yep, Stand Firm.
How do you know all this?
Because I'm a SageCon, but that's another story.
Huh?
As churches consider gathering again, they should develop plans to reopen and operate according to the guidance of the CDC, along with state and local guidance that does not violate the First Amendment and other religious freedom protections. Family Research Council has a helpful resource with best practices and tips for churches and places of worship to consider when crafting their reopening plans. Romans 13 instructs Christians to be subject to the governing authorities. The civil authorities have a difficult task ahead, and we should seek to be a part of the solution through cooperation and service to our communities. Some states and authorities like Nevada and California are treating religious entities more restrictively than non-religious entities. But as long as restrictions are temporary, applied equally to religious and non-religious gatherings alike, and there is a good reason for putting them in place, government restrictions are not likely to violate religious freedom protections. To learn more and to view this resource, visit frc.org/churchguidelines.
I'm Tony Perkins, and you are listening to Washington Watch. Let me remind you, the Values Voter Summit coming up next week, a week from today, the 22nd through the 25th. To find out more how you can be a part of it right from your own home, go to TonyPerkins.com. All right, California, I mean, the state is burning up. They're just so dysfunctional. They got so many issues going on there in California. But a California school district, in the midst of all of this, pandemic, fires, is adapting a radical sex ed curriculum for middle school students. Now, this comes despite pushback from students, I mean from parents, rather. The Santa Barbara Unified School District has adopted a curriculum for middle schoolers that includes lessons on choosing one's gender. You just come to school one day and you choose your gender. Finding birth control, like hide-and-go-seek. Abortion providers, how you can find the abortion provider, and then they also, in this curriculum, include condom demonstrations. Unfortunately, this is not new for the state of California. But finally, I mean, parents are having enough of this. Joining me now to talk more about this, the president of the California Family Council, Jonathan Keller. Jonathan, welcome back to the program.
Tony, it's always good to be with you and your listeners.
All right. So did I adequately describe the insanity that is taking place in the public schools through this sex ed curriculum?
Yeah, I think unfortunately so. I wish that you could be I could accuse you of overstating it or exaggerating. But the reality is it is as bad as you say. And it's arguably going to be worse because a large part of our fear is that beyond the official curriculum that is being approved in each of these school districts, there are dozens of organizations around the country, whether it's the Human Rights Campaign, whether it is here in California, their version of Equality California. They are working outside of the curriculum to provide additional supplemental resources and materials. So what you see approved is just the tip of the iceberg. There are going to be additional handouts, additional videos, additional in-class demonstrations that are going to begin happening in classrooms all across the state of California. And as we've seen so often, Tony, over the last few months, especially the last few weeks with Zoom in-person or remote learning, parents most of the time have very little idea what is actually being said inside of their children's classrooms. And I guess the one silver lining is that more and more parents are starting to hear these horror stories coming out of their children's classrooms, and they are beginning to maybe take a second look at whether they want their children subject to this type of indoctrination.
Now, there is one element of this that parents, if they know what's going on, they pay attention to what's happening and they actually get notified, they can opt their children out of this, but it's an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in. But a lot of this stuff is done in such a way that the parents are not familiar with this. But this is becoming really central to what is happening in America's classrooms. And this is a part of the radicalization that began under the Obama administration and has accelerated. Of course, California willingly and gleefully falling in line with that agenda. What are parents doing? How are they pushing back there in Santa Barbara?
Well, I think it's a similar situation to what we've seen happen across the state of California. Santa Barbara, San Diego, Encino, Elk Grove, you have parents across the state that are banding together. They are attending school board meetings. They are speaking out, and they are politely, respectfully, but forcefully demanding that their kids are protected from this type of indoctrination and exploitation. Tony, like you referenced before, a huge problem in trying to protect children from this is that very often it is hidden. These types of presentations are not just labeled simply as sex ed or condom demonstration. They are oftentimes woven through the social studies curriculum. Here in the state of California, we have a similar law that mandates the achievements, the historical achievements of LGBTQ people must be taught and celebrated in a positive way. Again, in elementary school curriculum, Tony, we have young kids being taught about the heroism and the bravery of people who are cross-dressers, people who dress in drag, and who, in the case of Harvey Milk Day, even individuals who enticed and seduced minors into a sexual relationship. So it's absolutely correct that parents need to continue pushing back. But the vigilance can't just stop at the sex ed curriculum. This is something that parents need to be aware of in every facet of their child's education.
Jonathan, only got about 30 seconds left, but is this a part of a bigger agenda that's being pushed in America's classrooms?
Absolutely. And I think you see this from everything to the curriculum that's being passed to the most recent Netflix documentary, Cuties, or documentary. It's fiction, but it really is basically a documentary of what we're seeing. And this most recent bill in California that were on Governor Newsom's desk that would mandate transgender treatments and surgeries for young people if it is signed in the next few days.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for the work that you do in California. I know it's a tough place, but grateful for your leadership, Jonathan.
Thanks, Tony. God bless you. God bless everybody across the country.
All right, Jonathan Keller, president of the California Family Council. Talk about a tough job there in California, and he does a really good job at it. If you're in California, you need to connect with him. Go to TonyPerkins.com, follow the links over. All right, when we come back, a psychiatry journal has had to issue a major correction because, well, we're going to talk about the because when we come back. So don't go away. More Washington Watch to come right after this. Masculinity in America has never been under attack the way it is today. We've reached the point where the term itself is considered toxic or offensive to many. The consistent message in our nation is that masculinity by nature is bad and is the root cause of many of the problems plaguing our society. From his experience as a military combat officer and ordained minister of the gospel, Lieutenant General William Boykin has seen and dealt with firsthand the breakdown of leadership in our nation by the lack of godly men living lives of biblical purpose. In his latest book, Man to Man, Rediscovering Masculinity in a Challenging World, he addresses the essential elements of manhood as a provider, an instructor, a defender, a battle buddy, and a chaplain. and explains how to personally develop these traits and pass them to the next generation. Get your copy today of Man to Man, wherever books are sold.
The rapidly changing moral landscape of the 21st century presents a challenge for Christians committed to biblical sexual ethics. An uprising against morality has overturned centuries of norms concerning the family, marriage, and human sexuality. Secular culture is not the only challenger of Christian sexual ethics. Increasingly, theologically liberal churches and denominations are rejecting the church's historic teaching on marriage. As a result, Christians are facing increasing pressure to compromise the Bible's teaching on human sexuality. How should Christians who are committed to God's Word respond to these challenges? What does the Bible teach about sexuality? Family Research Council has a new publication that presents the biblical principles for human sexuality. It lays out a survey of culture, scripture, and church history that will help pastors and all Christians meet modern-day challenges to biblical sexuality with truth and love. To access this publication, visit frc.org/human sexuality.
The history of the United States is preserved in archives, books, and the collective memory of the American people. It is also preserved through monuments and memorials that visually represent the extraordinary history of our nation. To tell these stories and remind ourselves of the importance of these memorials, Family Research Council has a new blog series highlighting the most recognizable and popular monuments in our nation's capital. This series devotes particular attention to the historical and spiritual themes depicted in each monument, sharing some not-so-well-known facts about their history, design, and symbolic meaning that shed light on our nation's deep religious heritage. This series aims to inspire the next generation to see the importance of these monuments and to remind us of the virtues and lessons that they memorialize. To read FRC's Monument Series, visit frcblog.org/monuments. Again, that's frcblog.org/monuments.
Welcome back. I'm Tony Perkins, and you're listening to Washington Watch, the website, tonyperkins.com. And again, let me remind you, the Values Voter Summit begins next week, next Tuesday night, a week from tonight, 8 p.m. To find out more about how you can be a part, go to tonyperkins.com and follow the links over to the Values Voter Summit. America, it's time to pray, vote, and stand. And by the way, take the challenge if you have not yet done that. Challenge to pray, vote, and stand. All right, before I get into my my next topic, I just have to play this clip for you. This was Kamala Harris over the weekend speaking on a roundtable on her economic plans that the Biden-Harris campaign is putting forth. Listen to this clip.
A Harris administration together with Joe Biden as the president of the United States, the Biden-Harris administration will provide access to $100 billion in low-interest loans and investments for minority business owners.
Now, did you catch that? It was a Harris administration. And she's getting a little ahead of herself, I think. I mean, you know, you talk about people measuring the curtains. I mean, she's almost like measuring the casket. I mean, she is... I don't know that I would want to be Joe Biden with her behind me. Just saying. All right. A psychiatry journal has issued a correction, at least the study that was in there. The authors of the study have issued a correction on transgender surgeries and their effect on mental health. So what is this correction? Joining me now to talk about this, Dr. Andre Van Mol. He is the family physician. He's a family physician in full-time practice. He's also the co-chair of the American College of Pediatricians Committee on Adolescent Sexuality. Dr. Van Mol, thank you for joining us here on Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me on, Tony.
Now, this is quite a significant correction, if you will, where this study essentially said, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the expert, I'm not, but that there was a claim that those that had gender dysphoria or incongruence with their gender, if they had a surgery that, for instance, you know, the gender correction or gender altering surgeries, that decreased their depression, which often leads to suicide and other mental issues if they had the surgery. They've had to correct that to say that there is no significant difference between those who have surgery and those do not. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was quite interesting here, Tony. The American Journal of Psychiatry, October 2019, the study was from Brandstrom and Pachankis, and it claimed, you know, to be the first total population study of Sweden, so, you know, 9.7 million subjects, looking at people of gender incongruence. And they looked at two things, the gender-affirming hormones and what they call gender-affirming surgery, what I think most people would think of as sex reassignment surgery. Did it reduce mental health service utilization? And they only looked at three endpoints, which were problematic themselves. Now, they themselves said in the study, okay, hormones, that didn't help, but surgery did. Now, our team really found a lot of problems with this study. And so myself, endocrinologist Mike Laidlaw, child and adolescent psychiatrist Miriam Grossman, probably known to some of your listeners by some of the books on their shelves, and Professor Paul McHugh of Johns Hopkins, and yes, I do mean that, Paul McHugh, I led our team to write a letter to the editor saying, look, there's problem after problem in this thing. What ended up happening August 1st, so 10 months later, in that edition of the AJP, they published seven critical letters, including our own, a major correction that functionally retracted the one positive finding of this study. They said, gee, we were concerned, of course, it was in very, you know, calm academic language, concerned with these problems found in the letters. So they actually hired outside statistical consultants to look over this thing, and the consultants agreed. They passed it back to the authors of the study and said, we'd like you to reanalyze your data. They did, including stuff that wasn't in the original study, and that showed no advantage to surgery. And there was also a letter from the authors in this same edition saying that their conclusion was too strong, which is certainly phrasing it mildly. And again, there were just a number of problems in this study.
Now, Dr. Van Mol, when that study came out originally, it was widely disseminated in many major media outlets. I mean, they really trumpeted this.
You bet.
So
yeah, that happens all the time. You know, the other side, what they do is pretty much as soon as the study comes out, I think they feed the information to the media. Here's how you should interpret this. Here's what it means. Here's the talking points. And you're left to assume. They say, of course, you're not anti-trans on you, so, you know, please phrase it this way. And then, of course, when something major happens like this, it's pretty much ignored. So I advised our teams and some others like them, look, why don't we do what they do? And so we started feeding the story to various media outlets. And it took a little while, but it's been catching on. Again, I don't think I'd hold your breath, you know, for the let's say the major legacy outlets to say too much about it. But what we have going here is remarkable. I mean, if this is, you know, all that they say, do the first of its kind study, this study shows that neither gender-affirming surgery nor gender-affirming hormones are helpful to reduce mental health utilization. So that's not nothing. I mean,
but
that's a finding that's worth knowing.
But, Dr. Van Mol, isn't that what's being pushed in many situations where these life-altering surgeries, which in many cases are irreversible, these are being pursued pretty aggressively, are they not?
Yeah, it's ideologically driven. It's fad medicine, and fad medicine's bad medicine. Of course, there's such powerhouses behind this, you know, the money behind it. You know, the guidance and all that, it's an uphill battle, but I think we've made tremendous progress. You know, our various teams that are working on this and others like us, just in the past 2 years, just among the main teams that I work with, we've gotten 8 commentaries and letters to the editor published in the peer-reviewed, you know, magazines, not even counting what we get in the general medical or the more popular publications. So the word is getting out, plus there's the rising tide of regretters and desisters who are now less afraid. I mean, because going up against the trans lobby is a fearsome thing. Mm-hmm. But they're less and less afraid seeing that there's support out there and the word's getting out. And it's very much, you know, blowing the narrative that the other side wants us to believe.
Well, I was going to ask you back that, Dr. Van Mol, with the you pointed that this is an ideological issue. It's being driven very fiercely because I think there is a – I don't think – I know. There's an effort to affirm this through the surgeries. And if that's the only option that's out there, it kind of locks people into it. It's hard to change once it happens. And so, I know, to borrow an old phrase, misery loves company to a large degree. But those who stood up against this and say, wait, not so fast. There's been a lot of, I'm just going to say professional attacks on individuals who have said this may not be the best course of action.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, there's the emotional blackmail on families that have gender dysphoric kids, you know, and the classic line is, oh, do you want a live son or a dead daughter? And of course, you know, how's a family supposed to respond to that? But emotional blackmail isn't truth or reason. You know, there are no long-term studies showing this is great stuff. It's not all that in a bag of chips. We have decades of studies showing, you know, tremendous prevalence of underlying problems, you know, psychiatric, you know, of a multitudinous sort, adverse childhood events, family problems in kids and adults who have this. And when you don't deal with those problems, they don't go away no matter how much cosmetic stuff you apply to it. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly for children, I mean, very solidly, we can say based on, you know, decades of literature, as well as things like the DSM-5, that the overwhelming majority of children with gender dysphoria will desist by adulthood. Easily, we can say 85%, higher in many. So why would you permanently medicalize a condition that is likely to go away by adulthood?
Let me, that 85%, is that just through the normal course of going through adolescence, or is that with the assistance of counseling and assistance?
No, that's the normal thing of the, you know, the way it's been. Now, it is strongly recommended that there be counseling assistance. I mean, the international standard of care on this has been what's called watchful waiting, precisely because it tends to go away by adulthood. But watchful waiting also implies that you're doing intensive and extensive psychological evaluation and support of both the child and the family. And the reason is clear: you are sure to find issues in both. So if you do bring the proper psychological insights, the results should be even better. But we have psychologists throughout the West telling us that they feel rushed to medicalize these kids. And if they show any hesitation and say, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm a mental health expert, let's apply some of my field to this, they get labeled transphobic. And it happens right. Fast and it happens hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Andre Van Mol, I want to thank you for joining us. I know you're going to be a part of the Values Voter Summit, so folks can hear more by joining us next week at the Values Voter Summit. So thanks so much for being with us today.
Appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
All right. And folks, he'll be a part of a breakout session on this topic next week, along with my next guest, who is joining me here in studio, Senior Fellow for Policy Studies here at the Family Research Council, Peter Spriggs. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you, Johnny.
I want to jump right into where we left off with Dr. Van Mol, that we talked about the counseling aspect, that, you know, counselors who would try to help kids through this are labeled, transphobic. But what's happening in states across the country is that I think we're somewhere around 19, 20 states that have actually prohibited parents from getting counseling for their children, you know, minor children who might be having issues with their gender identity. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, they've included gender identity in these therapy bans that were originally directed towards sexual orientation change efforts. But, of course, they don't want this therapy to be given to transgender kids any more than they want it to be given to kids who identify as gay or lesbian. And so we're in this odd situation, though, with the gender identity issue, where they're saying, oh, it's absolutely terrible and harmful and needs to be outlawed for you to sit down and talk with a therapist in a way that might help you become more comfortable with the body you were born in. But it's perfectly acceptable and indeed highly recommended that you engage in a number of mutilating surgeries to actually alter the body that you were born in.
Now, well, wait a minute. I'm missing something here, Peter.
Well, you're too logical, Tony.
It's dangerous for an adolescent to talk with a professional counselor, even if they want to. Adolescent wants to talk to the professional, the parents want them to talk to them because they're having some issues. That is harmful, but going under the scalpel and forever altering your body is acceptable. In the minds of the left.
That's the position of the left, and that's exactly it. And it is an irrational position, but it is absolutely what is being promoted by people in the transgender movement.
And I want to be perfectly clear here for our listeners. We're not talking about just preferences that the left doesn't want counselors to talk. They're using the force of law to prohibit it, even when the parent and the adolescent wants it.
That's right. I mean, they will often tell these stories about adolescents being forced into this or something, being coerced by their parents, parents who are abusive or something like that. But the fact is that the laws are written in such a way that they prohibit it, even if the child actually wants it and requests it. It's prohibited anyway. And in the case of the gender identity, again, the dynamics are a little different from the sexual orientation. But a number of people have brought out the fact that young people who want to adopt a transgender identity are being coached on what to say in order to get these medical treatments. Mm-hmm. So the idea of some of them may want the help, but some of them have been coached on how to resist getting that type of help, even though they may have other mental health problems that they really need or may have be on the autism spectrum and really need some help with those sort of things, but they're coached to avoid that.
So Peter, going back to the study that has had to make the retraction that I was talking with Dr. Van Mol about, is that there is no evidence to suggest that if an adolescent who has this gender dysphoria, that they go through this surgery, there's no benefit from a measurable standpoint.
Yeah. Now, this particular study that we were talking about with Dr. Van Mol is not focused specifically on minors, but I think the same thing is true about minors. Remember that this is different from most medical treatment in that most medical treatment is designed to help the body function better, body systems to function more normally. This is the opposite. It's to help people's mental health, to help them feel better mentally. And if it doesn't succeed in doing that, what is the point?
And we were talking about minors, but there are also prohibitions in certain states where even adults cannot get this type of counseling if they want it.
Well, there's an effort to do that using the theory the prohibitions on therapy for minors were based on the theory that they're too young, they're being taken advantage of, they can't give informed consent. But the prohibitions for adults are based on a theory that this is fraud. This is a form of fraud because you're telling people that they can change when they really can't. So they're two very different legal theories, but both towards the same end.
But using the weight of government to prohibit people from getting the counseling.
Exactly.
Peter Sprigg, thanks so much for joining us. And folks, you can hear more next week. Peter and Dr. Van Mol will be a part of a panel at VBS. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do and you've prayed, when you've prepared and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.